serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming down the home stretch with 97-year-old Dr. Russell Brookshire of Hanford, California. Scooter, as his friends called him in Jorhat, India during World War II, when he completed 78 missions in B-24s, earning the Distinguished Flying Cross, among other decorations.
You know, you mentioned in there somewhere the anti-aircraft fire from the ground, how uncanny it was that they could pinpoint your altitude. And all the bomber pilots I've talked to have made it clear there's no evading that. I mean, you're in formation, you're going straight
to
the target.
And you don't see them coming until they burst at black.
So in those 78 missions, were there some of those where some of that flak hit your plane?
Oh, yeah, we had flak damage on a number of missions. Sometimes an aircraft burst seemed like they were so close together you could almost walk on them.
But you have to keep pressing right through it.
Right through.
There's another story you wrote about here that you entitled, Just One More Time, Lord. The night was black, the moon was hidden above a 20,000 feet of thick monsoon clouds, rain limiting visibility to less than a half mile. My B-24 was the first in line for takeoff, the four mighty Pratt Whitney engines ticking over nicely. You're awaiting orders from the control tower to taxi into position to take off on runway 30. Cloud base was reported to be 400. The takeoff would be under instrument conditions. The order came to take the runway and was cleared for immediate departure to report on reaching altitude of 22,000 feet, and good luck. Second Lieutenant Brookshire, age 21, was at the controls, already a gifted plane commander. Co-pilot 26-year-old Raymond Adair, who was a newcomer and being trained to become aircraft commander of his own B-24 crew. Raymond was called Red, for obvious reasons. Lieutenant Brookshire was called Scooter and had more than 20 missions behind him at this point. Scooter, this is you, aligned his aircraft on the runway and applied full power to the Pratt Whitney R-1830 engines. The plane lurched forward, accelerating rapidly to 125 miles per hour. Visibility limited forward vision to approximately two city blocks. The red lights at runway end were not visible. Runway marker lights were passing under the wings faster and faster. Finally, the red end lights came into view, and Red said, Scoot, are we going to make it? And Scooter replied, piece of cake. Was that really your mentality? Piece of cake? When the runway's almost out and you can barely see?
It was too late to do anything about it, but pull it off the... If it was ready to fly, we'd make it.
It says, just then the big B-24 lifted off and was almost immediately in solid instrument conditions, flying totally blind. Scooter was uniquely qualified, having been trained in the Royal Air Force. Red, being a devout Catholic, crossed himself several times, pulled down his oxygen mask, required from ground up for night instrument flying, and settled down for a ride upstairs. Total instrument flying conditions continued through 17,000 feet. When B-24-7603 broke out into beautiful moonlit sky with stars like diamonds sparkling above. So that sounds pretty mundane, pretty peaceful. But it didn't end that way?
Well, you know, if no one was shooting at you, either anti-aircraft or fighters, it was a beautiful ride.
And it sounds like it stayed that way for about 3 hours. And then your tail gunner, whose nickname was Skinny, said, Scooter, we have company, bandits 3 o'clock high. And there were six zeros cruising 3,000 feet above you, but now peeling off, diving on you. That sounds a little scary.
Yeah, it gets scary.
Does something change for you at the controls when you hear something like that?
No, not at that time, because it depends on what direction they're coming in at you. And there's really nothing you can do as they're coming in on you. You can't maneuver it. Information, so you're straight and level, so to speak. The zeros would come in with a burst, usually peel off, and come back up for another run at you. I was amazed at the accuracy and the ability of the Japanese pilots.
So just what you know about these kind of situations. At the time you're 21, you've flown about 20 missions. But what you know about that kind of scenario, the odds weren't necessarily in your favor, were they?
No, they were never in our favor, really, because they're going to do some damage coming through. If there's any kind of firepower coming out of them, you depend upon your gunners to get as many as you can.
And this says here that you're receiving fire. Your tail gunner, Skinny, shot one zero down. Tracers are coming in. Every fifth shell's a tracer. Bill Stuffelfield on your right wing, his plane became a huge fireball. Didn't see any parachutes. That whole crew is gone. And you know that can happen to your crew in the next instant.
Yeah. We had self-sealing tanks. A shell could go through our tanks. They saved a lot of airplanes by that ability to take fire and not explode. But the Japanese did not have the self-sealing tanks. If the gunners hit one and happened to go through a tank, he was exploding or on fire.
Well, and it says that the B-24 on your left wing survived because of those self-sealing tanks, and their gunners kept firing, so that helped you guys out. Your crew chief in the top turret, Andy McKay, shot down another zero, so now there's three down, but there's still three zeros coming after you, and that's when a couple P-51s showed up?
Yeah, with a smile on her face.
That had to be a pretty good feeling to see those Mustangs arrive.
That's a reprieve.
So they shot, the P-51s took care of two more zeros, but there's still one more. I guess that one finally bailed on you, huh? Got scared away?
Yeah, boogered out.
But some of the debris from the plane that had exploded next to you had taken out your number four engine, so I left that part out. So you're down an engine, too, when those P-51s show up. So what would have happened if those P-51s didn't show up?
We'd have been one of those going down.
And you still had to bring that plane in.
On three engines, yeah. It slowed us down.
So you requested an emergency landing at Kunming. It says Scooter made his usual arrival, even on three engines. And then it says that you said something as you kissed the ground in Kunming. This says you muttered, "Just one more time, Lord."
It means thank you, Lord. Just one more time.
How did you deal with losing some of those guys you knew, some of those other pilots and
like,
their crews?
Like losing one of the family. But there was no time to mourn. Activities went on. Life went on.
Have you been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington?
Yes. In fact, Rusty and Anna went with me to the honor flight.
While you were there, while you're looking at that World War II Memorial and all those gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who didn't make it home, what was going through your head?
I was proud to see the memorial and proud of our country for showing the honor that they held for all of us guys.
Did you find yourself reflecting on any of those guys you knew that those stars up there represented?
Yeah. Lots of friends, you know, 75 years ago. Names escaped me and forgotten, but I'm fortunate that the Lord has been so good to spare me for all these years.
What about when you found out that Japan had surrendered?
Well, I was on the taxiway to take off when the tower notified us that the Japanese had surrendered. Most of the air crews got out and firing their 45s and flare guns. It looked like 4th of July. Left the airplanes on the taxi strips on the end of the runway and all ended up at the club, the officers' club. It was probably 6 weeks before we got back to the States because transportation from the various areas, we were fortunate that it only took 6 weeks or so to have transportation back.
And be honest with me. I'm not suggesting you haven't been honest. I know you have. But again, I'm just thinking, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. You're flying all these missions mostly before your 22nd birthday. I mean, you turned 22 just right before the Japanese surrendered. So you're a young guy. You've seen all these other planes shot down. You've come awfully close to that yourself, had to make emergency landings, had flak and fighters and weather. How many times, CBI, did you wonder, am I ever actually going to see my wife again?
You know, I'm not conscious of ever thinking that perhaps I wouldn't see her again, not knowing what the future held, but whatever it was, it had been good up to now.
Where did that confidence come from?
I don't know. I was honored, and I wondered why sometimes. Why did I get the Distinguished Flying Cross? Why did I get the Air Medal with Oak Leaf Cluster? Why did I get the Presidential Unit Citation? I didn't do anything but live day by day by day, do whatever we were trained to do. No, I have been honored all my life. In my marriage, 65 years, my kids, the Lord has been more than gracious.
So I've got to ask, what was it like to come back and see your wife again. Was that a happy reunion?
Oh, yeah. Like honeymoon all over.
And you stayed in the service. You stayed in the Army Air Corps until 1949, December of 1949. And you were flying C-54s, transports?
Loved it. I would have stayed in and made it as a career. But after World War II, there were so many pilots. They were decreasing the number. My name came up, and I was discharged. Not that I wanted to be, but I thought, okay, I'll take advantage of that and go back to college. Flew Mets for 4 years. I had an opportunity to fly for Pan American stationed out of Bangkok with a great increase in salary. But I mulled that over about 15 minutes and said, no, I want to go home. I want to have an ice cream shake from the corner of an ice cream store. I just wanted to live as a civilian. And I wanted to be with my wife. Of course, she could have been with me at Bangkok, but that was not home. Would never have been a home to me.
And what became your home right here in Hanford, California, sounds like a pretty unique way that you ended up here, because you go back to college, you go to medical school. Before you finished medical school, your wife found out about this community in Hanford. She was shopping for
that big bag,
the medical bag that you still have. She's shopping for a medical bag, and a gentleman tells her there's an opening for a doctor in Hanford.
A doctor was building it, had built several offices, and he had one vacancy left. He says, it's a nice little town, 9,000 people. Now it's, what, 60?
You practiced medicine here for 41 years. What was the significance of that for you? How fulfilling was that for you to be in this community and provide medical care for so many?
I enjoyed it. My patients were my friends. I delivered, took care of grandma and granddad, babies. And general practice, I loved, because you took care of the whole family. And every Christmas, I'd go through the accounts receivable. Those families that were hardworking, struggling families, wrote off their bills by the thousands of dollars worth.
What inspired you to do that?
Something that I wanted to do for them, for their trust in me, taking care of their families, putting their family's life in a lot of cases in my hands.
I'm not trying to make a connection that isn't there, but it just kind of hit me in thinking about the story we heard earlier. Here you're giving them an unexpected Christmas gift. Back on Christmas in 1944, the gift you got was just surviving, huh?
The gift I got for 78 measures was survival.
And now there's children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren who wouldn't be here if you didn't survive all those 78 missions.
Yeah.
Well, when you think back over that, 97 years old, you just had your 97th birthday. What would you say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Most proud of Pensy, my wife, my kids, all of them grown, families of their own, college-educated, all of them.
I know we're running short on time, but maybe we can finish on a bit of a lighthearted note. Maybe it wasn't in the moment, but certainly all these years later. Was there really a mustache fire to put out in your cockpit?
Burton, my roommate in India, as I told you, he was the squadron jokester. We were flying after put in about 70 missions. They allowed two plane commanders to fly. Otherwise, Burton and I both were sort of the introductory pilots, teaching the new pilot coming in how to fly a loaded, overloaded B-24. Anyway, Burton and I were flying together. He was a co-pilot in the co-pilot seat, and I was in pilot seat. And the oxygen system is two switches. One of them was a continuous flow of oxygen. The other one was on demand. As you breathed, the valve would open. And we were cruising along, well, I don't know how high we were then, altitude probably 18, 20, 22,000 feet. Burton was over there sitting, oxygen mask on, all of us. He was a cigar smoker. And he stuck a cigar in his mouth, reached in his jacket pocket, pulled out his lighter, pulled the oxygen mask off of his face, stuck his cigar in his mouth, and flicked that Zippo lighter. And nothing but blue flame emitted from that. And he had a gay 90 type of mustache.
Handlebar?
a hand of war. He was so proud of it. He greased that thing and twisted, you know, and it's just a blue flame. He pulled that off and it was slapping his face, and his it ended up his goggles were, you know, and it scared him half to death. Scared everybody. The crew chief was sitting in the gunny seat right between us.
Mm-hmm.
Scared the fool out of us. We laughed at Burton. And, of course, I had to tell it around over the base when we got back. He said, that damn Brookshire spreading all those stories.
The true story of the time he burnt his mustache.
Yeah.
Huh? Did he have any of it left when he got the fire put out?
It was savagely rearranged. And one side was just ruined, and he had to shave it off.
If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a short video of Dr. Brookshire telling that story, complete with a photo of him and his friend Jasper Burton with a post-fire mustache. The podcast version of this episode online has a few memories that wouldn't fit into our radio time today, so you might enjoy that as well. Thanks to Dr. Tom Enlow for suggesting we visit with one of his medical predecessors in Hanford, California, and thanks most of all to Dr. Russell Brookshire of the 1330th Army Air Force Base Unit, 97 years young. That's all the time we have today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.